Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all parties are on a listen-only mode. I would also like to inform you this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to hand the call over to Mr. Ken Frank. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Shelby. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second of our Night Sky Network's 2011 bi-monthly series teleconference. Okay, Shelby, if you would please open up the lines, we'll find out who's listening out there and what you're affiliated with before introducing our speaker this evening.
Good evening.
Yourself,
who do we have there?
Southwest Florida Astronomical Society.
Hi.
John Bunyan with Grants Pass Astronomers, Grants Pass, Oregon.
Hi, John.
Hi. Bruce Tinkler with the Amateur Telescope Makers of Boston.
All right.
I'm Dorsey of Whatcom Celestial Observers in Fernbrook, Washington.
Thanks, John Bray with Brazos Valley Astronomy Club in Texas.
Okay.
Stuart Myers from Amateur Astronomers, Inc. in New Jersey.
Sherry Adams with the Miami Valley Astronomical Society in Dayton, Ohio.
John Pasmino from New York Skies Astronomy, Inc. in New York City.
Hi, John.
Hi.
This is Linda Prince from Amateur Observer Society of New York. And hi, John.
Hi, Linda.
Hi, Linda.
Got a gap. This is me, the Michael Forrester from Astronomy.fm.
Hi, Michael. Nice to hear you back again.
Yep. Glad to be here.
Aloha from Paradise. John Gallagher, Hawaiian Astronomical Society.
Hi, John. You sound great.
How you doing, Ken?
Lee Green from the Twin City Amateur Astronomers in Normal, Illinois.
Boy, it's sure great to hear from so many of our members around the country who've joined this evening. Shelby, now, could you please mute the lines, and we'll introduce our speaker.
Certainly. Thank you.
We're pleased to have Carolyn Crow as our speaker this evening for her presentation entitled Views from Epoxy, Colors in Our Solar System. We also have the pleasure of having Marnie Bjornson, our ASP Educational Project Coordinator, who will be listening in along with all of us this evening, and monitor Night Sky Info at astrosociety.org. Hi, Marnie.
Hi, guys.
Carolyn Crow is a graduate student at University of California at Los Angeles in the Department of Earth and Space Sciences, and Carolyn's origin are from rural New Hampshire, where backyard astronomy was a favorite summer evening pastime of hers. And her free time activities include a passion for playing ice hockey, hiking, a penchant for museums, traveling, listening to jazz, cooking, and getting her semi-tractor trailer driver's license. And tomorrow is her birthday, so isn't this wonderful? She's taking the time out for us to do this on her birthday, coming up long weekend, we hope. Without further ado to our telecon audience, please welcome Carolyn Crow.
Hi, thank you. Just one point, I have not gotten my tractor trailer driver's license yet. That will be sometime in the future, though, as a goal. I first wanted to say thank you. I'm very honored to come and give this talk to you guys. I'm going to be talking about some research that I actually started as an undergraduate at the University of Maryland and recently just finished up. And if you are interested in learning more, we just got published in the Astrophysical Journal this month. And just taking another moment to give a great thanks to my advisor, Lucy McFadden, for this project and all of my other co-authors. So today I'm going to be talking about the colors of the planets in our solar system and how we can use that as a tool as we start to characterize extrasolar planets. So I'm going to switch to slide number 2. Before I go into more of the science, I thought it'd be interesting to just give a brief synopsis of me, which I always like to hear about other people in science. And as Ken said, I started out in New Hampshire, so I'm really happy that there's some other East Coasters listening in. And we would go outside, you know, multiple times during the summer, and we could see the aurora, and we could see the Milky Way, and I just absolutely fell in love with anything space-related. And so I decided to go to the University of Maryland to study engineering, aerospace engineering, and wasn't quite right, and bounced around, and took Astronomy 100, and aced the exams, and fell in love again, so I started working with the Epoxy mission. And after I graduated, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go to grad school yet, so I stuck around and continued working and then fell in love with meteorites and other space materials. And now I'm at UCLA, first-year student, working with Kevin McKeon on Apollo 15 samples, which is a lot of fun. Most people don't get to go in and say they play with moon rocks all day, but I do. So getting back to business, we'll go to slide number 3. I just want to give you a brief outline so you know where we're going to be headed today. I'll start out talking about why looking at the colors of our planets is important, how we determine those colors, and what those colors can tell us about the planets we're looking at and what implications this has for future observations. Slide 4. So why are colors important? Well, colors can tell us a lot about the objects we're looking at, and they're very simplistic measurements. So if you think about in everyday life, we look at fruit to determine the difference between lemons and limes. You know, one's yellow, one's green. And so we basically want to try and do this with planets, and hopefully by the end of this talk, I'll convince you that we can also do this for extrasolar planets around other stars. So next slide, which would be slide 5. So extrasolar planet research has expanded a lot within the last 15, 16 years since the discovery of the first planet. Most of these planets are very different than our own planets. They're, A, really, really big. They're multiple times the size of the mass of Jupiter. And they, a lot of them orbit really, really close to their star, so their orbital periods are in a matter of days, if not hours. So that means they have to be a lot closer in than even Mercury is in our solar system. So at first we thought this was really unusual. You know, it's nothing like that we see in our solar system. But as we did more research and looked at more systems, we found that this is actually quite common. And so the next major question came is, what about Earth-like planets? You know, as a society and as a people, for hundreds of years, we've been fascinated about the possibility of life on other planets. You know, is there another Earth out there? So this is kind of the major question and the major goal of our research was to, you know, figure out, can we pick out Earth-like planets from the range of planets that we see out there? So next slide, be slide 6. So we've become really good at detecting the presence of extrasolar planets, either by a transit method, which is when you measure the amount of dimming of starlight as a planet passes in front of a star, but you have to have the perfect alignment for that. And the other method that's been quite successful is the Doppler method, which is you can actually see pretty much the wobble in the star as the planets orbit around it due to their gravitational pull. So we've been able to find a lot of planets, but when it comes to characterizing them, that's a little harder. We actually have to take images of these planets and be able to resolve them from their host star. And that's how we need to get colors, is we actually have to take images of the stars, or sorry, of the planets. So this picture that I'm showing you here, just for a little bit of perspective, this is the Fomalhaut system. This is one of the first systems that was actually imaged by Hubble. And down in the right-hand corner is one of the planets that they detected. And this planet is 3 times the mass of Jupiter, and it's also 10 times as far away from its sun as Saturn is from our sun. So it's really far out, and it's really big, and we were able to detect this planet. But unfortunately, we want to look at Earth-sized planets, which are going to be a lot smaller and a lot closer in. So this is kind of difficult, and so we need to get better resolution instruments. If you go on to slide 7. So it's not completely hopeless. Kepler, which is up on the right-hand corner, just recently announced that they found over 1,200 candidate planets, and 68 of those are Earth-sized planets. So we've started finding the ones of the right size. A lot of those orbit closer in as well. But hopefully with next generation of telescopes, maybe James WST or instruments like Terrestrial Planet Finder in the future, hopefully we'll be able to start taking these images in order to start characterizing these extrasolar planets and not just discovering where they are. So go to slide number 8. I hope that you have a better understanding now of why it's important to look at these, the colors of the planets. And now we're going to look at how do we determine the colors of the planets. Slide number 9. So spectroscopy is a study and involves looking at how light interacts with surfaces, planetary surfaces. And as most of you know, light comes in many different wavelengths, from really long wavelengths, which we see on this image over on the left-hand side, of radio waves that are can be kilometers in length, all the way down to really, really short gamma rays, which can be the size of atoms, if not smaller. And the visible light, which is where we get our colors, falls right in the middle of that. And I was saying before, you know, you think about in everyday life, we have white light bulbs, or white light has all the colors in it, and you can separate those out by putting them through a prism, and you can see the rainbow. Another way to think about colors, which might be helpful for this talk, is so if you think of the white light coming out of your lamp and it shines off of your apple, and the red light reflects off of the apple into your eye, and so you're able to see the red light. And this allows us to determine between apples and oranges, lemons and limes. So, again, we want to do this for planets. But as scientists, we can't just look at the colors and say, oh, well, this looks more red or this looks more blue. We actually have to quantify it. So if you go on to slide 10. And this is done slightly different than how our eye perceives light. So if we look at this plot here, this is a plot of how sensitive our eye is to different colors of light. So on the horizontal axis, we have the wavelengths of light. We see it goes from 400 to 700 nanometers, and that goes from violet all the way to red. And then on the vertical axis, that shows you the relative sensitivity. So from this, we can see that our eye is very sensitive to green light. If you guys have ever seen the difference between somebody using a red laser pointer and a green laser pointer, at least for me, the green laser pointer seems a lot brighter and hurts my eyes a lot more. So it's along those lines. But if we're using a spacecraft, instead of our eye, we're going to use filter photometry. So we're going to take images of these planets through different filters that only allow certain wavelengths of colored light to pass through. So when I'm talking about colors later on of the different planets, they're going to be slightly different than how your eye would perceive them, which you guys probably already know, because our spacecraft is not does not have that bias towards green light that our eye has. So go to the next slide, slide 11. So this is an image or a artist's rendition of the solar system. It's not to scale. And we can already start seeing that there's such a range in colors all throughout our solar system. And there's also such a range of different types of bodies. You know, we have rocky, atmosphereless bodies like the Moon and Mars and Mercury. We have planets that have atmospheres and clouds like Venus and Earth. And then we have these huge gas giants with the Jovians further out. So our question was, can we characterize these different types of planets just based off of their colors? And can we pick out Earth, even more importantly, from all of these different planets just looking at their colors? Go to the next slide, slide 12. So we first started looking at just the Earth, the Moon, and Mars. And that was because we were working with the Epoxy mission. So you go on to slide 13. And those are the three bodies that the Epoxy mission observed. So just to give you a little background on the epoxy mission, this is the continuation of the Deep Impact mission, which smashed a probe into Comet Temple 1 a few years ago, which is, there's an image of it down on the right-hand corner. And once that mission was done, we had a still-functioning spacecraft with good instruments and extra fuel, so NASA decided to repurpose the spacecraft and go on this extended investigation. And so there's two parts of the epoxy mission. The first is EPIC, which is the Extrasolar Planet Observation and Characterization. And in this portion of the mission, they observe the Earth and the Moon and Mars as they would be viewed as extrasolar planets. So to start thinking about what would Earth look like as an extrasolar planet. They also observe transiting planets around other stars. And then the second portion of the mission is DIXI, which is the Deep Impact Extended Investigation. And this portion of the mission continued on the study of comets by flying by Comet Hartley 2, which I'll talk about in a minute. And for those of you that want to know a little bit more about the spacecraft capabilities, we're equipped with two visible cameras. One's a high resolution, one's a medium resolution camera, and we also have an infrared spectrometer, so we are allowed to do, or we're able to do a bunch of different types of science. You go on to slide 14. As an interesting side note, the DIXI portion of the mission just completed their flyby of Hartley 2 last November. If you haven't seen the images yet, this is one of the images of the comet nucleus, and it is this extremely active comet. They're gorgeous images and great science coming out of there, so I encourage you to take a look at that. Slide 15. So going back on topic again. These are some of the observations that we made. So in the center picture, this is actually a picture of the lunar near side. And it appears to look black and white, and that's because, remember, we're taking these images through filters. So it's basically showing us where the moon reflects red light. And you take an images through all the different filters, and so you can see what regions are reflecting blue and what regions are reflecting green and et cetera through all the filters. And you can either combine them together, like the image on the left. This is actually a color composite image of three different filters. And this is of the Earth and the Moon. That bright red region on Earth is actually the Sahara Desert. And we actually captured a transit of the Earth by the Moon. So the Moon actually crossed directly in between us and the Earth, so we could look at the far side of the Moon. Also on the right-hand side, those are some of our observations of Mars. And so we can either put together pretty color composite images, or we can sum together all of the light in the images to determine how red a planet is or how blue a planet is, just by comparing the intensities through the different filters. So we'll go on to slide 16. So now that you have a better idea of how we measure colors by taking images through these different filters, let's go ahead and look at some of our results and what these colors can tell us. We go on to slide 17. So this is the photometric data that we got of the Earth and the Moon and Mars with the epoxy spacecraft. So the horizontal axis here is wavelength again. So if you remember from the previous plot, the visible light ranged between about 400 and 700 nanometers. So around where it says 450, that's going to be red light. And around where it says 750, that's going to be, 450 is going to be blue light, and 750 is going to be red light. So if you go to shorter wavelengths, around 350, we're getting into the ultraviolet, which is why you wear sunscreen. And as we go to longer wavelengths, around 950, we're getting into the infrared light. So taking a look at these bodies individually, so take a look at Earth. Earth is this blue line on here. just as an aside note, these what look like error bars are not actually error in our data. We took images of Earth and Mars for one full rotation, so this actually represents how much the colors of the planets vary over a full rotation. So the Earth is the only of the three bodies that's really, really bright in the blue. So that means they're really, really high over in the left side of this plot. And you might automatically think, oh, well, that makes sense because our oceans are blue. But actually, it's actually due to Rayleigh scattering, which is the same reason why the sky is blue when you look up on a clear day, which is today is not a clear day in Northern California. But we looked into this, and if there was no Rayleigh scattering on Earth, Earth would still be a little blue, but it would not have nearly as big of this kick up towards the blue side. And as you look at it, as it goes out towards longer wavelengths, it's relatively flat, and that's because our clouds and our atmosphere don't really absorb any light at those wavelengths. So for comparison, if we look at Mars, Mars is really, really high on the right-hand side of the plot, which means it's really, really red, which you would assume anyways because Mars is supposed to be the red planet. But this is because as the light interacts with the materials on the surface, there's a lot of iron on the surface. It's actually absorbed a lot of the blue light, and so it appears really red. The moon, which is the third body on this plot, has similar processes going on. It's also an airless body with iron, so it has a similar structure as Mars. So already, even just by looking at these three bodies, we can see that there's different patterns of colors going on here, and there's multiple different processes causing these colors. So if you go on to slide 18. So what about the entire solar system? So if we expand our set to all of the planets in our solar system, there's even a larger range of colors and even a larger range of types of bodies. So if you thought the previous plot was semi-confusing, imagine if I were to put up the plot of all 10 of our bodies, which is all of the planets plus Titan and the moon on there. It'd be very confusing. So we decided not to do that. But we did go back and we found data for the other planets in previous studies by Karkoschka and Irvine, and did some slight extrapolations to figure out exactly what these planets would look like through our telescope or through our spacecraft. And then we went further, a step further, and said, okay, well, our goal was to pull out Earth-like planets. So we wanted to determine the best filters, the most optimal filters for pulling out Earth-like planets. So if you go on to slide 19, we determined that the three best filters for pulling out Earth-like planets were our blue filter, our green filter, and our red filter. And as I mentioned before, these colors don't necessarily line up with exactly what you would think of blue, green, and red as you would see something through our eye. So our blue is a little more towards the UV, and our red is a little more towards the infrared, but they're very close. So let me explain this plot to you before I start putting up different planets. So on the horizontal, which is the bottom axis, this is going to be red versus green light. So if a planet falls towards the right-hand side, that means it's going to be really red. So the redder planet's going to fall towards the right-hand side. If it falls towards the left-hand side, that just means that there's something absorbing light, like in Mars when we had, when the iron was absorbing the blue light. You can have different things that will absorb red light. On the vertical axis is the blue versus green light. And so this means that planets that are really, really, really blue are going to fall towards the top, whereas planets that have things absorbing blue light will fall towards the bottom. One other point to make is that if you have a body that completely, perfectly reflects all of the light, like a white piece of paper or something like that, it'll fall exactly in the middle of where those crosshairs are. So it kind of gives you a little perspective of where the different bodies should fall. So if we go on to slide 20. So this is where the Earth falls on the plot. It falls towards the top, because remember we were talking about earlier, it's got Rayleigh scattering. So if there was no Rayleigh scattering in the atmosphere, it would fall much closer to the one line on the blue versus green axis. It also falls relatively in the middle in terms of red light, and that's because it has a cloudy atmosphere that doesn't really reflect, well, it doesn't really absorb any of the red light, so it's almost a perfect reflector at those wavelengths. And the error bars, or the little bars around the Earth, are not error bars. They're that shows you how much the color of the Earth changes in one full rotation. So it's actually, it occupies a very, very small region on this plot. So what about the terrestrial planets that we looked at? So if you go to slide 21, you should now see Venus, Moon, Mercury, and Mars, in addition to Earth. So they occupy the lower right-hand quadrant of this plot for multiple different reasons. So when we were looking at the Moon and Mars earlier, we knew that they were airless, rocky bodies. So Mercury is very similar. And so they all fall down in this region because of the way that the light interacts with the surface soils. There's different materials in the soils that are causing it to fall in this region, but it is just due to the fact that there's no atmosphere and their soils absorb a lot of blue light, so they appear much redder. Venus, on the other hand, still occupies this quadrant down in the bottom. It's a very has a very cloudy atmosphere, like Earth has a cloudy atmosphere. And so on the red versus green, the horizontal axis, it falls relatively close to the middle, like Earth does, because its clouds are also very non-reflective at these wavelengths. But unlike Earth, it falls towards the bottom of the plot as opposed to the top. And there's two different reasons why this is going on. Venus's clouds are a lot higher in its atmosphere than Earth's clouds are, so there's not a lot of distance for Rayleigh scattering to kick in. And there's also a lot of aerosols in its atmosphere that have absorbed this this blue light, so it falls down towards the bottom. So we can start to see how different processes are affecting where these bodies fall on this diagram. So if we go to slide 22, you should now see all the Jovian planets and Titan in addition to Earth and the terrestrial planets. So all of these fall to the left-hand side of the plot. And that's because their atmospheres are dominated by methane and ammonia. And methane and ammonia absorb greatly at red wavelengths. So this pushes all those bodies to the left-hand side. Interestingly enough, Neptune and Uranus fall towards the top of this plot, or relatively close to the one line. And that's because they do have a lot of Rayleigh scattering in their atmospheres, which pushes them up towards the top. They do have a little bit of aerosol absorption, but they're mainly dominated by the Rayleigh scattering. Jupiter, Saturn, and Titan, on the other hand, all have large amounts of aerosol absorption, similar to Venus, in their atmosphere. So this pushes them down towards the bottom of the plot. So now I've explained to you why each of these bodies individually fall on this plot. But what about looking at it as a whole picture, looking at this plot as one big story? So there's three really important fun things that you can learn from this plot. So the first one is that just using these three filters, it stands out that Earth is all by itself. Earth is the only planet with this combination of colors. So that was what our major goal was initially, was to figure out, can we pull out Earth-like planets? And we were able to pull out Earth from Mars, so that was successful. The other thing that's interesting to notice is we can start picking out processes, not just types of planets, but processes. So on the vertical axis, the blue versus green, started to notice that all of the bodies with Rayleigh scattering, like Uranus and Neptune and Earth, those all fall towards the top of the plot. And as of right now, there needs to be a little more research into it, but right now that seems to be the only reason that we can find, or the only process that's pushing these planets towards the top of the plot. If you go to slide 23, the third thing that I find interesting, I'm not making any certain claims right now, but it's interesting to notice the pattern along the horizontal axis, so the red versus green, that we have this progression from the left-hand side where it's all of the Jovian planets with atmospheres dominated by methane and ammonia absorption to the center of the plot where we have smaller rocky bodies with cloudy atmospheres, and then over to the right-hand side where there are just rocky airless bodies. So this is another interesting pattern to see, that with these we can start separating out not only just planets or types of planets, but you know, possibly different processes that are going on. There are competing processes, so you know, we need to be cautioned that this is only a first order approximation, because we know why these planets have these colors because we have higher resolution data, and we've sent spacecraft to some of these places to take images, so we know what's going on. So if you switch to slide 24. So what does this mean about the future? Well, as I said before, I'm going to talk about how this applies to extrasolar planet research. And so we've already found tons and tons and tons of planets, or at least I think they're tons. So if we go to slide 25. So Kepler, as I said before, announced that they found over 1,200 planets. Some of them are Earth-sized. This is an artist's depiction of what Kepler-10b might look like. Kepler-10b is a 1.4 Earth mass planet, which has been determined to be rocky based on its density. So it also orbits, as again I said, it orbits really close into its parent star, so it's going to be hard to resolve from the starlight. But once we can start taking those images, so once our spacecraft get good enough that we can actually resolve these planets and take images of them, this is going to be the first way that we'll be able to characterize planets. And so if we were to take pictures of Kepler-B and we were to put it on the plot that we saw on the previous slides, just looking at its red, blue, and green light, if it falls closer to Earth on this plot than, say, Mars, you know, if it falls in that same region, then that's a pretty good chance that it's going to be more Earth-like than more Mars-like or more Jupiter-like. So although we won't be able to use the colors to determine if this planet is exactly like Earth, it'll definitely help us narrow down what planets are possibly Earth-like and which ones we should do more research into in order to figure out if they have water, if they're in the habitable zone, whether they have atmospheres that can sustain life. So So that is basically what we did for our study. You go on to slide 26. That wraps up my talk, and I just want to say thank you for listening, and be happy to answer any questions.
Cool.
Well, thank you again, Carolyn, for taking the time and effort for your engaging and, of course, colorful presentation on candidate planets for habitability. If we could have a question and answer period now. please, yeah. Shelby?
Certainly. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, star 1, please. Our first question is from Patrick O'Brien. Your line is open.
Well, hello, Carolyn. My name is Patrick O'Brien, just like I was announced. But
hi.
You presented a very adequate expert presentation. And my question is, because I'm with the Darien O'Brien Astronomy Club in Lakewood. However, I live in Omaha. And my question is on slide 22 and 23. I noticed that all the planets were listed, but you had Titan and the Moon, but lo and behold, Pluto isn't one of the planets because officially Pluto is no longer a planet. And my question is, well, that's a very nice color-to-color plot, but I was thinking maybe in addition to Titan and the Moon, maybe you could put Pluto down there.
Yeah, we didn't end up looking at Pluto. And I believe it was just for our published paper, we just looked at just the planets and a little bit at the moon. But it's actually really hard to actually find data sets back in the previous literature, and I can't remember if there was photometric data of Pluto or not. Somebody might dial in and correct me if I'm wrong. But yeah, no, that would be very interesting. It'd be very interesting to put a bunch of different planets on here. And one of the other things, and I'm glad you brought this up, that I would like to see done in the future is NASA has this virtual planetary laboratory where basically you can say, I want a planet with a atmospheric composition of X, Y, and Z, and you put in all these parameters, and it'll give you a really, really high-resolution spectra of what the planet would look like, and you can go and determine the colors of what this planet would look like and put it on our plot. So it'd be interesting to do things like what would an early Earth look like, or if we want to probe into, well, maybe what other things could be causing a planet to be blue, we could go to this this virtual planetary laboratory and make up different possibilities of planets and then see where they fall on this plot. So I would like to see more of that done, too, because I think that'd be interesting to see where made-up planets lie. So, but yes, good question. Pluto should be looked at.
Good job. Thanks, Carolyn.
You're welcome.
Our next question is from Stuart Myers. Your line is open.
Oh, hello. Nice presentation.
Thank you.
And so in case I forget, happy birthday tomorrow.
Thank you.
Now, I was going to ask, you know, that this color thing, it's very interesting, but I mean, you know, are there other processes that could make a planet resemble Earth but not really be like Earth in this process?
Of the processes that we know, the processes that we know in our solar system, I'm going to say no. For Earth, no. I don't know of any other one because for the Rayleigh scattering, Rayleigh scattering is dependent upon the size of the molecules in the atmosphere. So if we find a planet with Rayleigh scattering that's similar to Earth, I mean, the atmospheric composition might be different, but the particles are going to be the same size. Mm. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, so there could be, I mean, it might not necessarily be Earth-like, but if you think about like Jupiter and Saturn, and even Venus, there's a lot that we don't know, like the aerosols that are causing that absorption to make them fall towards the bottom part of the plot, we don't know what those aerosols are. So I think there should be a little more research into that because there's still so much that we don't know about our own planets in our own solar system. But for Earth, yeah, there's not very many known processes that could cause these colors. But the other planets are slightly different.
Yeah. Also, I think that if you're going to give an example of a exoplanet to be scrutinized by this process, Kepler-10b might not be the best example.
Right.
As it orbits extremely close.
It is.
Has a density consistent with that of iron.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I just put it in there because it's the first rocky or solid planet that they have announced. So I'm just, I just wanted to point out that we've started getting smaller planets, but most of them are.
Yeah, well, I think they said that five of those 68 Earth-like planets, Earth-sized planets, I should say, that they found with Kepler, five of them are thought to be inhabitable zones.
Yes, because, so that's another thing, too. So if you want to determine if a planet is habitable or not, it relies on also where it is in relation to its star. So there's a certain region around the star where it's warm enough to have liquid water, but not too warm that it all evaporates. And so this region is called the habitable zone. And I just read the famous paper recently, I can't remember the name, but they go through calculating where these habitable regions are based on the star type and based on how hot the star is, and then also how the star evolved over time. So as a star goes through its lifetime, it gets warmer, so your habitable zone is going to move out. So you also have to look a lot of where these planets are and around what stars they are. So there's many pieces to the puzzle, and I hope that this will be one of them.
All right. Well, thanks for the information, and I'm just curious, what got you interested in the CDL?
Pardon? What?
A CDL. In the little biographical sketch that they were doing, they were saying you were studying for your CDL, which is commercial driver's license.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. It just seems like something that a lot of people don't do, and it seems like something that would be very difficult. I've never driven a big tractor trailer.
Oh.
But, I don't know.
I thought you were, looking for a fallback option. Academia didn't work out. But
I don't know. I might want to do train operators. Hopefully the train systems will be better.
Yeah, well, I wish you luck with that project.
Thank you.
And I also wish you luck with whatever projects of an astronomical nature you're working on, too.
My lunar samples.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome. Bye.
Our next question comes from John. Your line is open.
Okay. I'm looking at the color diagram, and it reminds me very strongly of the ones we use when we study star clusters. But the vertical scale looks like a B minus V color index. The horizontal scale, I think we use like V minus R. Mm-hmm. You have a flip kind of with the R minus V, sort of. Is that because you developed this independently of the astrophysicists?
Yes. So our filters don't perfectly line up with the standard filters that you use for looking at star clusters. But one of my co-authors is at the moment trying to convert these measurements that we've made into what your, the RBV filters would be. So, because those are more commonly used. So we're trying to do that conversion to see what it would look like through those filters. But yes, it's along the same lines, the same exact way of thinking for this plot.
Yeah, the filters were those which were on the spacecraft. I mean, these are not supplemented by Earth-based, are they?
I believe it's spacecraft.
Yeah, right, because then you're stuck with those filters. But I think for the other planets besides Mars, Moon, and Earth, they were viewed also by the Deep Impact?
The planets other than the Mars, Moon, and Earth were viewed from ground base, but they were either higher resolution spectra that we figured out what, summed up the light and used our sensitivity of our filters to figure out what the colors would look like. Or there was some, we used some narrow band photometry that covered a wide range of wavelengths as well.
Okay, and a final point, I'll let you go and happy birthday. And the sensitivity curve for the human eye, spectral sensitivity, Are we still using, I'm going back a long ways in photometry, 680 lumens per watt as the efficacy for the peak wavelength?
I do not know off the top of my head.
I'm sorry?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Over and out.
Our next question comes from Bruce. Your line is open.
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you for a very interesting presentation, and you did a great job. And you've given us a lot to think about, specifically, why the colors are the way they are and what we ought to be looking for. I was wondering if you could speculate into the future with how we might be able to get enough light from these extrasolar planets and whether or not using diffraction grids along with space-based telescopes might be the way to do that.
Yeah. So there's some interesting ideas and concepts that are being thrown around of different ways to do this. So basically what you have to do is you have to find a way to block out the starlight, from the star so you can resolve the planet. One thing that I've heard of recently is something called an occulting disk, which is...
Right. Actually, that's what I meant. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. So basically what an occulting disk would be is, I think they're speculating of doing this with JWST. And so once JWST gets up there, you would actually have a separate spacecraft that would fly in front of the camera and would block out the light of the star. It seems pretty promising. You would have to pick and choose what stars you're going to do as well, because if you get the fainter stars, it'll be easier to resolve the planet light. But I'm hopeful. I haven't done the calculations myself to figure out whether or not we get this resolution. But, yeah, there's a lot of ideas like that being thrown around, and I'm very hopeful that they'll work out.
Yeah, but between that kind of technology advance and ongoing missions like Kepler, we should have a lot of choices to go look for.
Yes. So, yeah, pairing between the Kepler, the Kepler mission, and we've gotten really good at finding the planets. It's just the next step is now we have to characterize them, and that would be done with JWST or other similar instruments with occulting disks.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
No further questions at this time.
All right. Well, thank you again, Carolyn, for taking your time and effort for engaging us in this wonderful presentation.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
It was
fun.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say it was fun. I was very happy to do it.
Great. If you happen to be in Baltimore, not you necessarily, but I hope we can see you there, in July 30th through... July 30th through, I think, August 4th, the ASP, in partnership with the American Geophysical Union and the Space Telescope Science Institute, will hold a national conference on science education and public outreach entitled Connecting People to Science, to be held at the Tremont Plaza Hotel. And for more information, check the ASP website. And remember to log your Globe at Night events. Starting a few days ago, it was on the 22nd, on March 22nd through April 4th, and you can still win the Globe at Night Dark Sky Kit as well as a sky quality meter. And our next telecon is Thursday, May 19th, with Dr. Jeffrey Van Cleef, and he'll present Stargazers, Starfarers, and Kepler. It's pretty much on the parallel theme. So stay tuned. And thanks, everyone, and good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks.
Thanks again. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Thank you for your participation. This concludes today's call. You may disconnect at this time.